This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What happens here in Nigeria is felt around the world. And that, in a nutshell, is why I've come to Abuja. The United States knows that on most of the urgent challenges and opportunities we face, Africa will make the difference.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on the role that Africa plays in many critical global issues. Details coming up. Also, following two deadly suicide bombings in Kampala, Ugandan police say they have killed five suspected terrorists. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Africa has to be part of the solution in key global issues ranging from climate change to pandemics, democracy, and economic development. The continent has the youngest population in the world with a median age of 19, meaning its role in the future will become even larger. In a speech today to the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, Blinken announced the U.S. will hold an Africa summit to further deepen ties with the continent. On the second leg of his three-nation visit, Blinken used the continent's most populous country as an example of the region's influence.
What happens here in Nigeria is felt around the world. And that, in a nutshell, is why I've come to Abuja. The United States knows that on most of the urgent challenges and opportunities we face, Africa will make the difference.
Blinken also discussed renewed cooperation with Nigerian authorities to tackle the coronavirus pandemic, climate change, security, and human rights concerns.
As we work to end the COVID-19 pandemic and strengthen global health security, we must work closely with the countries of Africa to build public health systems here that can prevent, detect, and respond to future emergencies. Because as these past 2 years have taught us, none of us are completely protected unless all of us are protected. As the urgency of the climate crisis grows, our focus will increasingly be on Africa to solve an emergency that threatens our collective security, our economies, and our health. Here, where the potential for renewable energy is greater than anywhere else on the planet, we see not only the stakes of this crisis, but also its solutions.
He called the situation in Ethiopia very, very challenging, and that if a peaceful solution could not be found, then we really risk seeing violence increase, suffering increase, and potentially the state of Ethiopia pulling apart. Blinken repeated calls for Sudan's military to return the country to civilian rule and stop using deadly force on peaceful protesters, saying it is totally, totally unacceptable. Ugandan police say they have killed five suspected terrorists, including a Muslim cleric, during raids following two deadly suicide bombings Tuesday in the capital Kampala. Police say they are looking for a second cleric who is suspected of recruiting youth to carry out terrorist attacks. Analysts warn Ugandan police must enforce security according to the law to avoid encouraging further recruitment. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Ugandan security agencies Thursday morning raided the home of a suspected terrorist in Kampala, killing him and arresting his wife. Ugandan police say Sheikh Muhammad Chirivu, alias Abbas Chirivu, was involved in recruiting personnel into the ranks of the Allied Democratic Forces rebel group and promoting the reemergence of ADF cells within Kampala. Since Tuesday's suicide bombings, which killed four people, security agencies have carried out raids in different parts of the country. Police say a total of 21 suspected ADF terrorists and collaborators have been arrested in Kampala and the districts of Luero and Ntoroko. Police spokesman Fred Enanga says four others were killed.
During the violent encounter with them in Ntoroko, there was an exchange of gunfire and our counter-terror operatives managed to put out of action a group of four suspected terrorists who form part of the recruitment and logistical coordination network.
Enanga says the four suspected terrorists were closely linked to the number five commander of the ADF, only identified as Lubinsa. He says they were crossing back from the Democratic Republic of the Congo through one of the poorest crossing points in Chisege, Ntoroko district. The counterterrorism unit is now searching for another cleric.
We are now intensifying the manhunt for Sheikh Suleiman in Subuga, who is one of the main actors behind the recruitment, training, radicalization. He's been providing material support and resources to the domestic terror cells and also providing resources and materials on the use of explosives and destructive devices.
The ongoing raids are raising questions on whether Uganda's security forces are operating within the law or are just being reactionary. Jason Stans is director of the Congo Research Group at New York University. He says the ADF, which is allegedly affiliated with Islamic State and has carried out attacks in Rwanda and Mozambique, in addition to Uganda, is using violent attacks not to overthrow the Ugandan regime, but to attract international recruits from sympathizers and funding from both the region and abroad. He says the ADF is also useful for some governments in the region, particularly Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, because it gives them an excuse to crack down on opposition groups and attract international support, especially from the United States. But Stans warns the current security reaction will only further the cause of the ADF.
Nothing would boost the ADF's recruitment drive more than to having a violent crackdown on Muslims or even on people affiliated with the Tablighi sect, for example, in Uganda. And so it's important when dealing with threats like this to properly calibrate the response so as not to exacerbate the problem itself.
In a statement Tuesday, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni tried to reassure Ugandans, saying the government was more than ready to deal with urban terrorism. He referred to the killed suspects as manipulated victims of confusion. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Morocco's King Mohammed VI has announced that the Western Sahara is an integral part of Morocco, calling on the world to follow the U.S. model and recognize Moroccan sovereignty over the region. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi why the king did not mention other countries by name.
He's holding up the United States as the model that he would like other countries to follow. The United States was the first country to recognize Morocco's claims, although there are 24 countries that have put consulates in Western Sahara, which is a kind of de facto recognition of Morocco's claims, right. And then another 45 or so that fully back sort of Morocco's version of the facts and Morocco's plan marching forward, and new African countries that have joined on following Moroccan diplomatic efforts on the continent. And so he sees sort of a hierarchy of the Americans, then the countries that have joined with Morocco with these consulates, and then the countries that are maybe going to follow the U.S. in recognition, and making a strong case to the Europeans that he'd like them to follow the same direction. But it is remarkable that the king isn't naming other countries here, you know.
Professor Lawrence, the Moroccan king warned countries who display vague positions on the Western Sahara that Morocco will not engage them in any economic or commercial deal that does not include the Western Sahara as a part of Morocco. What's your take on that?
On the negative side of his message, he's directing this at the European Parliament and the European Court, which is taking decisions that Morocco is not happy with. And he's trying to lay down a marker saying, we don't want you to be ambivalent. We don't want you to have a court decision on one side that says fishing can't happen over here. And then, you know, a minister that comes in and says, well, maybe we can do some fishing over here, or whatever the issue is. So he's definitely sending a message that he wants more coherence in the European position, coherence that lines up with the direction that Morocco wants everybody to move in. Some may move in more quickly than others. How this plays out, I think, remains to be seen. Morocco is escalating with everybody, you know, resulting in the breakdown of the ceasefire last year and the developments with Algeria. And there's a game that's being played, you know, a game in the sense of strategy. With Spain, there's one with Germany, there's one with France, which is closer to the Moroccan position. There's one with the European Union institutions, all of which follow the U.S. recognition and tying it to the Abraham Accords. But he's saying, look, we want everyone to move in this direction. And he's saying, we may not deal with you. We may sort of escalate in that sense in order to try to get further concessions the way we want. Both Algeria and Morocco have been escalating with France. So if Algeria was doing no escalation, they might be in a position to maybe look more cooperative to the Europeans. But Algeria is also escalating in a very interesting way vis-a-vis Europe. And so that creates, I guess, maybe a certain balance. They can sort of jockey for position vis-a-vis the European.
How do you think the Europeans would respond to the Moroccan king's call to follow the example of the United States vis-a-vis the Western Sahara?
First of all, the Europeans want good relations with both Morocco and Algeria. And so the escalation along the berm, right, the escalations in airspace and the jockeying is not something Europe looks at happily, you know. And then this escalation game, what the various European entities' positions are, is also something Europe doesn't look on kindly. But that doesn't mean that Europe won't approach or warm to the Moroccan position. It means that they're going to look for ways in which they can accede to or get along with the Moroccan position without angering the Algerian too much. And it's not easy. And as I said, Algeria's also escalated. We've had incidents along the berm, a violent incident. We've had all kinds of accusations towards Morocco. And a new personalized politic. Tebboune cut relations with French over one sentence Macron said to a group of students while Tebboune was visiting. He escalated on a number of files based on things said and then takes these actions. And so that puts Morocco, I think, in a better position. But both sides' escalation towards Europe creates a real conundrum. And to be honest, Europe's going to try to probably remain more ambiguous than not. And that's why the king is playing this card, saying, look, please follow the United States, move in the direction that we want you to go in. My great fear is that the war gets worse. And every move Morocco has made indicates Morocco doesn't want an armed conflict, but there's always a risk.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. A new report by the United Nations Children's Fund says there are an estimated 240 million children around the world with disabilities. The UNICEF study compares data from 42 countries and covers more than 60 indicators of child well-being. They include nutrition and health, access to water and sanitation, education and protection from violence and exploitation. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more on the story.
The new global estimate for the number of children with disabilities is higher than previous ones. UNICEF say it is based on a more meaningful and inclusive understanding of disabilities, which considers physical and social factors that can affect functioning as well as symptoms of anxiety and depression. Yetivet Mola is a disability inclusive specialist for UNICEF's Eastern and Southern Regional Office. She says the report should definitely influence how the various countries view and program initiatives for children with disabilities. She says over the years, the number of children with disabilities have heavily been underreported. Mola says 10.5% of children in Eastern and Southern Africa are disabled as compared to 15% in Central and Western Africa, the highest number of all regions captured by the report.
Children with disabilities are more disadvantaged than their peers without disabilities for a while. And so that has been a kind of a statement which we used to use. But now we have more concrete figures showing that children with disabilities have lower access on education. So different measures have been used in terms of nutrition, in terms of access to water and sanitation, hygiene, in terms of protection from violence, exploitation and abuse.
She says, according to the report, children with with disabilities are 24% less likely to receive early stimulation during childhood, while 42% of such children were less likely to skills in reading and simple maths like addition and subtraction. She also says 51% of children with disabilities are likely to be unhappy, while 41% of them are likely to be discriminated against by their peers. Mula says it is critical for countries to use data from the report to plan for budgets for child protection programs and for inclusive education, including early childhood development for children with disabilities.
It's critically important that governments invest in inclusive quality education if they really want to break the cycle between poverty and disability. When children with disabilities are educated, they can afford to pay for their medical services, they can afford to pay for their housing.
She says governments must not only provide policies that will bring needed change, but also provide resources, leadership, and structures to improve the lives of children with disabilities. Mola says governments should also undertake various advocacy and capacity building programs to ensure that data from the report is used to allocate resources for programs that support these children. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Underscoring the need to bolster commerce, several heads of states attended the opening session of the second Intra-African Trade Fair in Durban, South Africa. Exhibitors showcased their goods and take in dedicated sessions on trade and investment opportunities under the African Union's Africa Continental Free Trade Area Agreement. The agreement, which aims to make Africa the largest free trade area in the world, came into effect on the 1st of January. Vicky Stark reports.
The Secretary General of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area Secretariat, Wamkele Mene, said the fair is a platform to ensure there is contact and bridge building.
Business to business, government to business interaction, where the private sector will have an opportunity to improve its knowledge of the integrated market that we are presenting through the AFCFTA. The participants will be in a position, after having exhibited, to determine new market potential in other parts of the continent, to identify the main needs of the market in Africa, as well as niche markets that are most likely to be successful and to drive implementation of the AFCFTA. For the exhibiting companies, this trade fair is an opportunity for further interaction with buyers and sellers across the African continent.
Mene says by providing a large and attractive market with reduced cross-border barriers, Africans can now undertake larger investment projects on a continental scale rather than a national or regional scale, hereby positioning the continent for investor attractiveness, not only for intra-Africa investment, but for global investors.
In my view, the next wave of investment into African markets should focus on productive sectors of Africa's economy in order to drive the continent's industrial development in the decades to come. In recent economic history, very few previously developing countries have achieved high income status without a strong industrial development path. In this regard, the challenge for us will be to work together to ensure that the industrial development that we desire the AFCFTA to foster is inclusive of all countries in Africa, particularly those countries who today may not have the same industrial capacity as others.
Mene says the AFCFTA has the potential to unlock value chains for investors in key sectors such as pharmaceuticals, automobiles, agro-processing, and financial technology.
In the area of pharmaceuticals, in 2019 alone, our continent imported $15 billion worth of pharmaceutical products. This is an opportunity for us to leverage the AFCFTA, particularly in the area of intellectual property rights, to assert Africa's productive capacity and to ensure that our intellectual property rights are at the service of Africa's public health imperatives, as well as at the service of Africa's industrial development objectives. With the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, as we all know, less than 3% of Africans have been vaccinated. The key question that confronts us is how to reconfigure our intellectual property rights regime under the AfCFTA to boost Africa's capacity to manufacture vaccines, not only for this pandemic, but for future pandemics, and also to manufacture generic drugs to ensure public health in Africa.
While it was launched at the beginning of the year, much work remains to iron out the details of the free trade agreement, but Mene reminded those in attendance that it took the European Union 72 years to reach the level of market integration that it enjoys today.
We know from the experience of the European Union that the journey to market integration is difficult and that it takes time. However, I am encouraged by positive projections that by the year 2035, where we implement this agreement effectively, we stand a chance to contribute $450 billion to Africa's combined GDP, an opportunity to lift 100 million Africans out of abject and moderate poverty, particularly benefiting small medium enterprises and women in trade. These positive projections, of course, will not happen by chance. We as Africans will have to roll up our sleeves, work hard, and ensure that we overcome the challenges. I'm very positive about the prospects of the future of our continent based on the very first steps that we've taken to overcome the challenges of market fragmentation on our continent.
The Inter-African Trade Fair runs until the 21st of November. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
As the demand for healthcare workers grows across the globe, in Zimbabwe's capital already has a shortage of nurses and other medical workers. From Harare, reporter Kuzaza Nwashi has the details.
Ruben Akili is a project officer with the Combined Harare Residents Association. He says the situation is worrying.
The situation on the ground in terms of opening of clinics, the situation is dire. We have been conducting meetings where pregnant women were engaging with local nurses, but it has emerged that there is a mass exodus of nurses due to poor working conditions. The situation is not good, as many health personnel are leaving. So you will see that most of the workers are overburdened.
Pride Mukono is a political analyst. He says, when workers are not happy with their employer, they have the option to strike or to exit.
The second option that nurses or any other worker can enjoy is what we call labor market exit, where you basically then look for better options elsewhere and you simply leave. And this is what we are witnessing now.
Linda Masarira is the leader of a political party called Labor Economists and African Democrats.
It is imperative for the local authority to start recruiting more nurses to beef up the staff at local clinics, as this is detrimental to the maternal health care service that is being afforded to pregnant women in various communities. We've got thousands of nurses that are unemployed, and the departure of cancer nurses going to greener pastures is not an excuse not to recruit more nurses.
Mukono says nurses have been overworked and underpaid during the stressful COVID-19 times. Now other countries seeking to bolster their workforce in the health sector are making it easy for workers from Zimbabwe to migrate. What's more, he says, welfare for ordinary citizens is going to get worse with Zimbabwe's life expectancy going lower. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.